communists in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
Everywhere I look around the world, the question is, what maybe we're going to lose next?
This is the first intercontinental conference of so-called colored people.
We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you, it's strictly up to you.
The 1960 presidential election was fought primarily on the issue of communism.
Above everything else, the American people want leaders who will keep the peace without surrender for America and the world.
Positioning himself like Barack Obama in 2008 as the candidate of change, young challenger John F. Kennedy was able to take the strongly anti-communist Republican Richard Nixon to task for failing to prevent a missile gap and for permitting the establishment of a communist regime only 90 miles from the Florida coastline.
It certainly appears that the 34th man to occupy the White House will be 43-year-old John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
To those nations who would make themselves our adversary, we offer not a pledge, but a request that both sides begin anew the quest for peace. Before the dark powers of destruction, unleashed by science, engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction.
Kennedy, America's first Catholic president, won a narrow and perhaps a stolen election. But he did take Washington and the world by storm with his wit and graceful elegance. His administration was nicknamed Camelot after King Arthur's mythical Round Table of Peace. His opportunistic but politically astute choice of Lyndon Johnson of Texas as vice president confirmed the liberal wing of the party's distrust of him. Elected to the Senate in 52, Kennedy had been a Cold War liberal who had avoided criticizing Joseph McCarthy, an old family friend. His younger brother Robert had even served on McCarthy's staff. Alluding to the title of his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage, Eleanor Roosevelt said she wished that Kennedy had had a little less profile and a little more courage. His team, a combination of insiders from foundations, corporations, and Wall Street firms, as well as progressives and intellectuals, was labeled the best and the brightest for their intelligence, achievements, and can-do spirit, typified by National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, the first applicant to get perfect scores on all three Yale entrance exams. At Defense, Kennedy brought in a civilian outsider, Robert McNamara. Renowned for his computer-like mind and leading the Ford Motor Company, he quickly earned the immediate distrust of his generals by putting the Pentagon under microscopic scrutiny. A devastating nuclear war plan had been handed down to them from Eisenhower. McNamara was appalled by what he found, a culture of paranoid worst-case scenarios. When Kennedy asked the statistically minded McNamara to ascertain just how big the missile gap really was, it took 3 weeks to confirm that there was no gap and several months to find out that there was quite a huge difference. The U.S. had approximately 25,000 nuclear weapons, the Soviets 2,500. The U.S. 1,500 heavy bombers, 1,000 of them in Europe within Soviet range, the Soviets 192. The U.S. 45 ICBMs, the Soviets 4.
This is Cuba, where communism has established its first bridgehead in the Western Hemisphere. It provides communism with a convenient arsenal of planes, tanks, and modern weapons, just 90 miles from American shores, only 7 minutes by jet.
Kennedy was briefed on Eisenhower's invasion plan for Cuba by Allen Dulles, who assured him that the Cuban people would rise in support. Several civilian advisors took sharp issue with the plan, but the inexperienced president feared blocking an operation backed by Eisenhower and the Joint Chiefs. 3 days before the operation, in April 1961, 8 U.S. B-26 bombers flown by Cuban exiles incapacitated half of Castro's Air Force.
The United States has committed no aggression against Cuba, and no offensive has been launched from Florida or from any other part of the United States.
Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, in an embarrassing prequel to Colin Powell's performance at the UN over Iraq in 2003, showed a photograph of a plane supposedly flown by a Cuban defector, but quickly exposed as belonging to the CIA.
The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro.
Almost 1,600 Cuban exiles arrived at the Bay of Pigs in 7 ships, 2 of them owned by United Fruit. But Cuban troops were ready, and no popular uprising ever occurred. The invaders begged for direct U.S. support, and much to the shock of the CIA, Kennedy refused this support, as he warned he would, fearing a Soviet countermove against West Berlin. At a midnight meeting, military leaders and the CIA chief of clandestine services pressed Kennedy for 3 hours to send ground and air support. They expected it. Eisenhower would have done it. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said it was reprehensible, almost criminal, to pull the rug out. But Kennedy stood his ground. 114 rebels were killed, roughly 1,200 captured. It was to be a chilling beginning to one of the most turbulent decades that would ever change the world, the 1960s.
Heads up, America, let's stand prepared with our defenses high. Heads up, America, a land that is prepared can never die.
It's an old saying that victory has 100 fathers and defeat is an orphan. Through the statements, detailed discussions are not to conceal responsibility, because I'm the responsible officer of the government.
The entire sordid affair had a profound effect on the president, who told an influential journalist friend,
The first advice I'm going to give my successor is to watch the generals and to avoid feeling that just because they were military men, their opinions on military matters were worth a damn.
He seemed to begin to understand what Eisenhower was warning about, but his learning curve would need to be a sharp one to escape the steel trap of Cold War thinking. Publicly, Kennedy took full responsibility for the fiasco. Privately, he was furious at the Joint Chiefs' sons of bitches and those CIA bastards, threatening to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the winds. Incredibly, he fired Allen Dulles, albeit diplomatically, and 2 other top officials. And all CIA overseas personnel were placed under State Department control. Kennedy's growing mistrust of his military and intelligence advisors made it easier to rebuff their pressure to send troops in 1961 into the tiny, landlocked Asian nation of Laos, something that Eisenhower had warned him might be necessary to defeat the communists.
Laos, strategic buffer state between the Red Bloc and Free Asia, is watched with concern by all the world.
The Joint Chiefs wanted Kennedy to give prior commitment to a large-scale invading force. Arthur Schlesinger, an aide and respected historian, later said,
"After the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy had contempt for the Joint Chiefs. He dismissed them as a bunch of old men. He thought Lemnitzer was a dope."
And as a result, Kennedy opted for a neutralist solution, which angered the Pentagon. It would come back to haunt him. The mood was dark when Kennedy traveled to Vienna to meet Khrushchev at their first summit conference that June of 61. Khrushchev berated the young president for America's global imperialism.
We in the USSR feel that the revolutionary process should have a right to exist.
The major issue for Khrushchev was Germany. What terrified him was the prospect of West Germany finally getting control over U.S. nukes deployed so close to the Soviet Union. And also by 1961, approximately 20% of the East German population, some 2.5 million people, had fled through the open border, seeking a better life in West Germany. It was an open sore humiliation for the Soviets, who now wanted a treaty recognizing two separate Germanies and the withdrawal of Western forces from West Berlin. Khrushchev explained to an American journalist,
"We have a much longer history with Germany. We have seen how quickly governments in Germany can change and how easy it is for Germany to become an instrument of mass murder. You like to think in the United States we have no public opinion. But don't be sure about this. We have a saying here, give a German a gun, sooner or later he will point it at Russians. Now, we could crush Germany in a few minutes, but we fear the ability of Germany to commit the United States to start a war, an atomic war. How many times do you have to be burned before you respect fire?"
Kennedy's parting comment to Khrushchev was,
I see it's going to be a very cold winter.
"We have wholly different views of right and wrong, of what is an internal affair and what is aggression. And above all, we have wholly different concepts of where the world is and where it is going."
Later that summer, Kennedy intensified the crisis with a saber-rattling speech.
"The source of world trouble and tension is Moscow, not Berlin. And if war begins, it will have begun in Moscow and not Berlin."
Increasing the army by 300,000 men, tripling the draft, and called for a national program to construct public and private fallout shelters. He reminded citizens,
"In the thermonuclear age, any misjudgments on either side about the intentions of the other could rain more devastation in several hours than has been wrought in all the wars of human history."
The Warsaw Pact nations responded in dramatic fashion. On August 13, East German troops began erecting barricades and roadblocks all across Germany to shut off the stream of escaping East Germans. The barbed wire was soon replaced with concrete. Kennedy, in defiance, sent 1,500 U.S. troops by road from West Germany into West Berlin, where they were met by Vice President Johnson. That same month, Khrushchev resumed nuclear testing. When Kennedy learned of this, he erupted, fucked again. Despite the U.S.'s nuclear superiority, the Air Force wanted to increase the missile count to 3,000. McNamara fought them down to 1,000 as the compromised number. The Soviets, by October, were detonating a 30-megaton bomb, the biggest yet exploded. And the next week, a 50-plus megaton bomb, over 3,000 times as powerful as the one dropped on Hiroshima. Kennedy had inherited by now the full wrath of Dulles's brinksmanship. To an outside observer, it might have seemed that Americans had taken leave of their senses in the summer and fall of 61 as the nation conducted an extended conversation on building fallout shelters in their homes, as well as the ethics of killing neighbors or friends to protect that shelter.
"Got a bunch of your neighbors outside who want to stay alive. Keep on doing what you're doing and we'll bust our way in there."
Despite media pressure, surprisingly, few people actually built shelters, either out of a sense of numbed resignation or the recognition of the difficulties of a meaningful survival. In hindsight, the construction of the monstrous Berlin Wall actually defused the immediate threat of war, enabling Khrushchev to appease his hardliners. Kennedy confided,
"It's not a very nice solution, but a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war."
In another part of the world, however, Kennedy had given his commitment to the politically important Cuban exile community in Florida to overthrow the Castro government. This would spark significant tensions with the Soviet Union. In early November, he unleashed Operation Mongoose, a terror campaign overseen by his brother Robert and run by Edward Lansdale, designed to wreck Cuba's economy and, among other things, secretly continue the up-to-now bungled assassination attempts on Castro. Seeking a pretext for military action, the Joint Chiefs approved Operation Northwoods, which included a Remember the Maine incident modeled on the ship sinking that triggered the Spanish-American War in 1898.
Delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
This plan included staging a Cuban government hijacking, shooting down of a civilian airliner, sinking boatloads of Cubans escaping to Florida, and blaming the communist government. Kennedy rejected the plan, but U.S. actions throughout 1962 convinced the Soviets that a Cuban invasion was imminent. In January, the U.S. coerced Latin American countries to suspend Cuba's membership in the OAS. The U.S. conducted a series of large-scale military exercises in the Caribbean in the spring, summer, and fall of 62. One involving 79 ships, 300 aircraft, and more than 40,000 troops. The last one in October, with 7,500 Marines set to participate, was codenamed Ortsak, a mock invasion of an island replete with the overthrow of its government. The message was clear. Kennedy was equally intent on standing up to the communists in Vietnam. But as a student of history, he must have harbored doubts about another land war in Asia. As a young congressman, he had visited Vietnam in 1951 during the debacle of the Korean War and advised against aiding the French colonialists, and later spoke broadly of needing to win the support of Arabs, Africans, and Asians who hated the white man who bled them, beat them, exploited them, and ruled them. He had already pointed out the contradiction of supporting the French Empire in Africa and Asia while opposing Soviet moves in Hungary and Poland. But he was now president and was soon defending a corrupt South Vietnamese government that was banning public assembly, some political parties, and even public dancing. Embracing Eisenhower's domino theory, Kennedy was now insisting that Vietnam represented the cornerstone of the free world in Southeast Asia, the finger in the dike. Lyndon Johnson went to Vietnam in May of 61 and anointed Diem the Winston Churchill of Southeast Asia, and painting a bleak picture pressed for a much larger U.S. involvement. The generals and even McNamara agreed that only U.S. combat troops could forestall a communist victory. However, Kennedy, a decorated veteran of World War II, resisted sending in combat troops. He said to Arthur Schlesinger,
The Troops will march in, the bands will play, the crowds will cheer, and in 4 days, everyone will have forgotten. Then we will be told we have to send in more troops. Well, it's like taking a drink. The effect wears off, and you have to take another.
But he was an admirer of guerrilla warfare in World War II, where British and Americans had fought behind the lines in places like the Burma jungle. And he did approve his general's other recommendations expanding military involvement. The U.S. personnel in Vietnam jumped from 800 when Kennedy took office to over 16,000 advisors in 1963. He also allowed a growing army of CIA and numerous American civilian contractors to flock to this new honeypot of enterprise. Under Kennedy's 3-year watch, the CIA launched 163 major covert operations worldwide, only 7 fewer than had been conducted under Eisenhower in 8 years. Vietnam, in its early stages, was sometimes referred to as a CIA war. At West Point, Kennedy reinforced this by saying it was
another type of war, new in its intensity, ancient in its origins, war by ambush, eroding and exhausting the enemy instead of engaging them.
History knows the contrary proved to be true in Vietnam. Under Kennedy, and mostly unknown to the American public, the U.S. began resettling villagers at gunpoint in barbed wire enclosed compounds guarded by unreliable South Vietnamese government troops, and using herbicides to defoliate guerrilla areas. The long-term environmental and health effects would turn out disastrously for Vietnamese and Americans alike. But it would be the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962 that truly impressed upon Kennedy the potentially disastrous repercussions of his hardline Cold War policies. On a Sunday, October 14th, a U-2 surveillance plane brought back photographic evidence of Soviet medium-range ballistic missiles in position in Cuba. It was quite a shock. Khrushchev had lied to him, promising no offensive weapons in Cuba, but he was making a blunder of epic proportions. The last thing the Soviets wanted in 1962 was a direct military confrontation with the U.S. With little more than 10 ICBMs that could reliably reach U.S. soil and fewer than 300 nuclear warheads, they stood no chance against the U.S.'s 5,000 deliverable nuclear bombs and nearly 2,000 ICBMs and bombers. Why did Khrushchev do this? The American public never understood. The media presented Soviet actions in Cuba as a case of outright Soviet aggression. But from the Soviet point of view, it was a reasonable response to repeated signs that the U.S. was preparing a first strike against the Soviet Union. The missiles might also deter the looming invasion of Cuba, which in a sense had now become a pawn in the game. The missiles would make the U.S. think twice before attacking, as Khrushchev said, giving the Americans a little bit of their own medicine. There was also no question that Khrushchev genuinely admired Castro, who had come to power on his own, without outside help, and had enormous symbolic value in the Third World. Finally, the missiles were an inexpensive way for Khrushchev to placate those who questioned his leadership in the communist world. But it was so dangerous, what he did, so dangerous. In his thinking, Khrushchev had intended to announce the presence of the nuclear missiles on November 7th at the 45th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. But as military analyst Daniel Ellsberg has pointed out, by keeping secret the fact that he had delivered tactical cruise and ballistic missiles along with their nuclear warheads, Khrushchev had transformed a potentially effective means of deterring a U.S. invasion into a destabilizing provocation that backfired. The U.S. never understood the warheads had already arrived.
The whole point of the doomsday machine is lost. If you keep it a secret, why didn't you tell the world, eh?
It was to be announced at the party congress on Monday. As you know, the premier loves surprises.
Even today, few realize the gravity of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and even fewer seem to grasp its enduring lessons. Dulles's legacy of brinksmanship, of going to the edge, had finally spawned its Frankenstein monster. 2 days later, Kennedy met with his key advisors in a top-secret meeting, hoping to stop the missiles before they were fully installed. 3 days later, on October 19th, he met with his joint chiefs. They pushed for a surgical airstrike without warning to remove the missiles, followed by an all-out invasion of Cuba. LeMay assured Kennedy that the Soviets would not respond. LeMay welcomed nuclear war as inevitable in a war that his country was currently in a position to win. There might not be a second opportunity. He fulminated against the Russian bear.
Let's take his leg off, right up to his testicles. On second thought, let's take his testicles too.
After the meeting, Kennedy remarked to his aide, Kenny O'Donnell,
if we listen to them and do what they want us to do, none of us will be alive later to tell them that they were wrong.
With U.S. missiles in Turkey, so close to the Soviet Union, McNamara contended that the strategic balance of power was not changed. Kennedy agreed, but understanding the political symbolism, said that allowing the missiles to stay would weaken the perception of the U.S. across the world, and especially in Latin America. He confided to his brother Robert that if he didn't take strong action now after what he did at the Bay of Pigs, he'd be impeached. This moment became a crucial test of Kennedy's character. In the context of building that character, he'd fought bravely and saved men's lives as a naval lieutenant in the South Pacific, and was now no longer as intimidated by uniformed generals. In the coming days, he would reject the advice of such older men, as well as Paul Nitze, Dean Acheson, and even Dwight Eisenhower. He opted instead for a blockade, which he referred to as a quarantine, to downplay the fact that this too was an act of war. On October 22, 8 days after the pictures were taken, Kennedy solemnly informed the American people.
All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
He portrayed the U.S. as an innocent victim of unprovoked Soviet aggression, not revealing that we'd been fighting a terrorist war against Cuba since late 1959.
I know that some action should be taken, but he's going to have to tread very lightly, short of war.
Well, I think it's high time we stopped Russia from having things her own way.
The temperature of the world shot up. People were on edge, transfixed to their televisions and radios. Children watched the news, their parents full of fear. That same day, the Strategic Air Command went to DEFCON 3. 2 days later, for the first time in history, to DEFCON 2, prepared to strike targets in the Soviet Union. The decision to go to the precipice of nuclear war was made under the authority given by Eisenhower by SAC Commander General Thomas Power without consulting the president. Thereafter, the SAC fleet remained airborne, refueled by aerial tankers. It was Power who, in 1960, told a defense analyst, "The whole idea is to kill the bastards. Look, at the end of the war, if there are two Americans and one Russian, we win." The analyst responded, "Well, you better make sure that they're a man and a woman." A series of harrowing incidents occurred, any one of which could have triggered a Holocaust. A SAC test missile was launched from the U.S. towards the Marshall Islands, and officials mistakenly reported that Tampa and Minnesota were under attack. On October 25, the Soviet leaders decided they would have to remove the missiles, but still hoped to trade them in Cuba for U.S. Jupiters in Turkey. Before they could act on that decision, Khrushchev received faulty information that the invasion of Cuba was beginning. By the 26th of October, American planes were flying over Cuba at treetop level. 250,000 troops were assembled off the Florida coastline ready to move. 2,000 bombing sorties were planned. Castro predicted a U.S. strike within 72 hours. The 42,000-strong Soviet force, commanded by a Stalingrad veteran and backed by 100,000 Cubans, possessed, unknown to American intelligence, approximately 100 battlefield nuclear weapons. Khrushchev was losing control of the situation. In an amazing moment, he asked his generals if they could guarantee that holding this course would not result in the death of 500 million people.
Now, what good would it have done me in the last hour of my life to know that though our great nation and the United States were in complete ruin, the national honor of the Soviet Union was intact?
In what McNamara described as the most extraordinary diplomatic message I have ever seen, Khrushchev sent Kennedy an urgent letter asking simply for a promise not to invade Cuba. He warned that the two countries were heading inexorably towards war.
It would not be in our power to stop it. War ends when it has rolled through cities and villages everywhere, sowing death and destruction.
On October 27th, an incident occurred that Schlesinger described as not only the most dangerous moment of the Cold War, it was the most dangerous moment in human history. The Russian ships were heading toward the quarantine line. One of four Soviet submarines sent to protect the ships was being hunted all day by the carrier USS Randolph. More than 100 miles outside the blockade, the Randolph began dropping depth charges. Unaware the sub was carrying nuclear weapons. The explosion rocked the submarine, which went dark except for emergency lights. The temperature rose sharply, the carbon dioxide in the air reached near lethal levels, and people could barely breathe. Men began to faint and fall down. The suffering went on for 4 hours. Then the Americans hit us with something stronger. We thought, that's it, the end. Panic ensued. Commander Valentin Savitsky tried, without success, to reach the general staff. He assumed the war had already started and they were going to die in disgrace for having done nothing. He ordered the nuclear torpedo to be prepared for firing. He turned to the other two officers aboard. Fortunately for mankind, the political officer, Vasily Arkhipov, was able to calm him down and convince him not to launch, probably single-handedly preventing nuclear war. In the midst of this harrowing confrontation, the breakpoint came when the National Security Council received word that a U-2 plane had been shot down over Cuba. Khrushchev had not authorized this. The Joint Chiefs wanted to act immediately and take out all the firing sites and missiles. Kennedy said no. The shooting down of the U-2 made both Kennedy and Khrushchev realize they were losing control of their enormous military machines. Americans receiving continual television broadcasts were paralyzed in the grip of something they had only dreamed about. Robert McNamara later said, as he watched the sunset come over the Potomac Saturday night, the 27th of October,
"It was a beautiful fall evening, height of the crisis. And I went up into the open air to look and to smell it, because I thought it was the last Saturday I would ever see."
Soviet diplomats were burning their files in Washington and New York. Washington insiders had begun to quietly evacuate their families from the Capitol, telling wives and children to drive as far south as quickly as possible. In a last desperate effort, Kennedy sent his brother to meet with the Soviet ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin, on that Saturday to tell him the United States was about to attack unless it received an immediate Soviet commitment to remove its bases from Cuba.
"The United States will pledge to never invade Cuba or aid others in that enterprise.
If your Jupiter missiles in Turkey were removed also, such an accommodation could be reached."
"That's not possible. The United States cannot agree to such terms under threat. Any belief to the contrary was in error."
"You want war?
However, while there can be no quid pro quo on this issue, the United States can offer a private assurance. Now, our Jupiter missiles in Turkey are obsolete and have been scheduled for withdrawal for some time. This withdrawal should take place within, say, 6 months. Of course, any public disclosure of this assurance would negate the deal and produce the most stringent denials from our government.
This private assurance represents the word of the highest authority.
Dobrynin conveyed the urgency to Khrushchev, who claimed in his memoirs that Robert Kennedy's message was even more desperate, that the president is not sure that the military will not overthrow him and seize power. The next morning, a Sunday, October the 28th, dawned with mercy. The Soviets announced they would withdraw the missiles. The world breathed as if there was only one collective breath for all. The crisis would actually continue behind the scenes for 3 more weeks and finally ended on November 22 when the Soviets were able to regain control of their battlefield nuclear weapons from the Cubans. The weapons would actually leave Cuba. It's interesting to note in hindsight that during the entire crisis, Soviet missiles were never fueled, Red Army reservists were not called up, and no threats were made against Berlin. 30 years later, in 1992, McNamara was shocked when told that if American troops had invaded, not only were there 4 times as many armed Soviets in Cuba as reported, but 100 battlefield nuclear weapons would likely have been used. Realizing that 100,000 Americans would probably have died, McNamara said the U.S. would have responded by wiping out Cuba with the high risk of an all-out nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Hundreds of millions of people might have perished, possibly all mankind. It has recently been discovered that on the island of Okinawa, a large force of missiles with megaton nuclear warheads and F-100 fighter bombers armed with hydrogen bombs were preparing for action. Their likely target was not the Soviet Union, but China. Military leaders were furious when the crisis ended without an attack on Cuba. McNamara recalled their bitterness.
The president invited the chiefs in to thank them for their support during the crisis, and there was one hell of a scene. Curtis LeMay came out saying, "We lost. We ought to just go in there today and knock them off."
It was Khrushchev, even more than Kennedy, who deserves the lion's share of credit for having avoided war. And for this, he was vilified, as Mikhail Gorbachev would be 3 decades later when he democratically presided, against his will, over the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The Chinese charged Khrushchev with cowardice for caving in. Russian hardliners said he had shit his pants. Much of the Pentagon, however, believing that its willingness to go to war had forced the Soviets to back down, determined that superior force would also work elsewhere, especially in Vietnam, where it was necessary once more to make a stand against communism. The Soviets drew the opposite lesson, determined never again to be so humiliated and forced to capitulate from weakness. They began a massive buildup of nuclear weapons to achieve parity with the United States. Weakened by the crisis, Khrushchev would be forced out of power the following year. But first, he wrote Kennedy a long letter.
Evil had brought some good. People have felt more tangibly the breathing of the burning flames of thermonuclear war.
In light of this, he made a series of bold proposals for eliminating
everything in our relations capable of generating a new crisis.
He suggested a non-aggression treaty between NATO and the Warsaw Pact nations. Why not, he said, disband all military blocs, cease testing all nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, in outer space, underwater, and also underground. He proposed solutions to conflicts over Germany and China. It's interesting to note that there was a remarkable revival of Christianity at the same time, with the short-lived papacy of Pope John XXIII, one of the most popular popes ever. He called together the Second Vatican Council, which issued a new encyclical that shook up the Catholic world. It was called Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, and ushered in a change in thinking, particularly in Latin America, where its priests, nuns, and laypersons took the message of the Gospels to the poor and the persecuted, encouraging them to take their fate into their own hands to overcome the misery of their existence. What became known as liberation theology led to many ensuing problems with Kennedy's successors in the backyard of the United States. Although more tepid to Khrushchev in his response, Kennedy's thinking was evolving, and in the year following the missile crisis, underwent a remarkable transformation. He began to see Vietnam as one place to step back from the East-West confrontation, but he knew it would not be easy. The debate over Kennedy's true intentions in Vietnam has at times been quite acrimonious, and his own contradictory statements and mixed signals have added to the confusion. Clearly, he was under enormous pressure to stay the course. And as late as July 1963, Kennedy told a news conference,
"For us to withdraw would mean a collapse, not only of South Vietnam, but Southeast Asia."
In private, however, he was voicing doubts. In late 62, he asked influential Senator Mike Mansfield to go there and evaluate the situation. Mansfield returned with a highly pessimistic assessment, recommending the U.S. withdraw its forces. Aide Kenny O'Donnell described Kennedy's reaction.
"The president was too disturbed by the senator's unexpected argument to reply to it. He said to me later when we talked about it,
'I got angry with Mike for disagreeing with our policy so completely. And I got angry with myself because I found myself agreeing with him.'"
On the 11th of June, 63, in an image that shocked the world, Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Quang Duc burned himself to death at a busy Saigon intersection to protest the corrupt South Vietnamese government. McNamara began pressing the Joint Chiefs for a plan of phased withdrawal. Kennedy approved the plan in May of 1963, but could not formalize it. The first 1,000 men were set to depart at the end of that year. In September, he sent McNamara and his trusted new Chief of Staff, General Maxwell Taylor, on a 10-day fact-finding expedition to Vietnam. They gave the president their report on October 2. It called for withdrawing troops before the end of 63 and completing it by the end of 65. Kennedy now formalized his commitment in his National Security Action Memorandum 263, which he signed on October 11th and released to the press. Kennedy, no doubt, was torn. He'd explained to his close aide, Kenny O'Donnell,
"In 1965, I'll become one of the most unpopular presidents in history. I'll be damned everywhere as a communist appeaser, but I don't care. If I tried to pull out completely now from Vietnam, we'd have another Joe McCarthy Red Scare on our hands. But I can do it after I'm reelected. So we better make damn sure I am reelected."
The Republicans were after his scalp. New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller charged that he was soft on communism, naively believing the Soviet leaders were reasonable and desirous of reaching a fundamental settlement with the West. Rockefeller, who was a moderate Republican, said, "The foundations of our safety are being sapped." Kennedy hadn't stopped communist aggression in Laos. He had failed to provide air support during the Bay of Pigs and stood idly by while the wall was being built in Berlin. Coming up behind Rockefeller was the extremist Republican, Senator Barry Goldwater, who would actually win the nomination in 64. As late as October 1963, in the hope that the situation in South Vietnam could improve, Kennedy supported the overthrow, but not the assassination, of the oppressive Diem regime. When the Vietnamese president and his brother were killed by the South Vietnamese military, Kennedy was visibly and extremely upset. Nonetheless, his mindset did not change. Among those who later came forward with confirmation of Kennedy's intention to withdraw were Robert McNamara, Arthur Schlesinger, Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, and Assistant Secretary of State Roger Hilsman. Daniel Ellsberg, later in 1967, interviewed Robert Kennedy prior to the shift in public opinion on the war. Kennedy said his brother was absolutely determined not to send ground units. Ellsberg asked him, would his brother have accepted defeat at the hands of the communists? And Robert Kennedy replied,
we would have fuzzed it up. We would have gotten a government in that asked us out, or that would have negotiated with the other side. We would have handled it like Laos.
Ellsberg asked him why his brother was so clear-headed when most of his senior advisors were still committed to prevailing. Robert responded emotionally.
Because we were there. We were there in 1951. We saw what was happening to the French. We saw it. My brother determined never to let that happen to us.
During the remarkable last few months of his life, Kennedy even contemplated a course reversal on Castro's Cuba, a relationship in which his policies were consistently wrong-headed. But just as he clung to the hope of victory in Vietnam while taking steps towards withdrawal, he endorsed a new round of CIA sabotage in Cuba while exploring several avenues of discreet contact with Castro himself. He told Jean Daniel, an influential French journalist who was about to meet Castro,
I believe that there is no country in the world where economic colonization, humiliation, and exploitation were worse than in Cuba, in part owing to my country's policies during the Batista regime.
Daniel finally met with Castro 2 days before Kennedy's assassination. Castro, expressing criticism of U.S. behavior, but admiring Kennedy's potential, also held out hope for a new departure. Kennedy, in the heart of the Cold War, was facing the abiding truth of American politics. One must be strong, and if one is perceived as soft or weak, one does not endure. And that is the confusing thing about power. Kennedy himself was quite ill from Addison's disease and the effects of spinal operations from World War II injuries. Addicted to painkillers and his own ravenous appetites, finding himself in a cocoon of deceits, not only to himself, but to his wife, to his Cuba and Vietnam policies, and to the country. John Kennedy yet seemed aloof from fear. Like Roosevelt, he embodied a grace that forgave much in the new era of television reality. In June of 1963, in a commencement address at American University, without input from the Joint Chiefs, the CIA, or the State Department, Kennedy gave one of the most extraordinary presidential speeches of the 20th century. He encouraged his listeners to think about the Soviet people in human terms and called for an end to the Cold War.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is sad to realize the extent of the gulf between us. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal.
In September of that year, the Senate passed the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty by a vote of 80-19. Presidential speechwriter Ted Sorensen believed that no other accomplishment in the White House ever gave Kennedy greater satisfaction.
For this treaty is for all of us. It is particularly for our children and our grandchildren, and they have no lobby here in Washington. According to the ancient Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles must begin with a single step. My fellow Americans, let us take that first step.
And in another stunning reversal, Kennedy called for replacing the space race, perhaps his most signature initiative, with joint U.S.-Soviet exploration of space and an expedition to the moon. He said,
"International law and the United Nations Charter will apply. Why should man's first flight to the moon be a national competition?"
By the time John Kennedy drove into downtown Dallas to begin his re-election campaign for 64, he had made powerful enemies in the upper echelons of the intelligence, military, and business communities, not to mention the mafia, southern segregationists, and both pro- and anti-Castro Cubans. In their minds, he was guilty of not following through on the Bay of Pigs, disempowering the CIA, firing its leaders, resisting involvement in Laos, concluding the Test Ban Treaty, planning to disengage from Vietnam, abandoning the space race, encouraging third world nationalism, flirting with ending the Cold War, and perhaps most damningly, accepting a negotiated settlement in the Cuban Missile Crisis. The rage towards him was visceral. Kennedy had read the best-selling 1962 novel, 7 Days in May, which portrays a coup d'etat by a Joint Chiefs of Staff furious over a liberal president's new nuclear treaty with the Soviets.
"Your course of action in the past year has bordered on criminal negligence. This treaty with the Russians is a violation of any concept of security. You're not a weak sister, Mr. President. You're a criminally weak sister."
He told a friend,
"It's possible. It could happen in this country.
If there were a third Bay of Pigs, it could happen."
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom in New York City. There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas.
A dark page in the annals of America has been written to the crack of an assassin's bullet. A nation mourns, the world grieves. The man who became 35th president less than 3 years ago is dead.
The Warren Commission, strongly influenced by ex-CIA Director Alan Dulles, later concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Although, unlike most single assassins with a cause, he firmly denied his guilt. The case against him was made effectively by the national media, but 4 of the 7 Warren Commission members expressed doubts. Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, Governor John Connally, who had been wounded, also questioned the findings. The public found the report unconvincing. We may never know who was responsible or what their motive was, but we do know that Kennedy's enemies included some of the same forces who had cut down Henry Wallace in 1944 when he was trying to lead the United States down a similar path of peace. Khrushchev would suffer an equally ignominious, though less bloody, fate as he was ousted by Kremlin hardliners the following year. He became a critic of the Soviet government and smuggled his memoirs out of the country to be published in the West under the title Khrushchev Remembers. Became a bestseller. When he died in 1971, he was buried in a corner of a Moscow cemetery. No monument was erected for years. Future generations owe an enormous debt, and possibly their very existence, to these two brave men who stared into the abyss and recoiled from what they saw. And they owe a special debt to an obscure Soviet submarine commander who single-handedly blocked the start of a nuclear war. With the ascension of Vice President Lyndon Johnson, there would be important changes in many of Kennedy's policies, particularly towards the Soviet Union and Vietnam.
I will do my best. That is all I can do.
In his inaugural address in the morning of that decade in January 1961,
let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans.
But with his murder, the torch was passed back to an old generation, the generation of Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, leaders who would systematically destroy the promise of Kennedy's last year as they returned the country to war and repression. Though the vision Khrushchev and Kennedy had expressed would fall with them, it would not die. The seeds they had planted would germinate and sprout again long after their deaths. For those of us who lived through the 1960s, the Cuban Missile Crisis, coming on the heels of the war scare over Berlin, was a terrifying event. It was one of many nightmares, call it punches to the stomach of a new generation of American people who had never seen history unfold so quickly, so dramatically, and in such a violent fashion. It would soon be followed by the invasion of Vietnam, a bloodbath, a nightmare of America's own making that would eat Vietnamese and Americans alive for almost a decade. More horrifying things were to come by the end of that decade. But in hindsight, it was on that afternoon in Dallas, when John Kennedy's head was blown off in broad daylight, it was as if a giant, horrific Greek Medusa had unearthed its hideous face to the American people, freezing us with an oracle of things yet to come.